Fine. So let's try to finish this up. At least the basic principles here of Ches Gimel Shanim. So, as we noted a few days ago, one of the possibilities in this sugya is that by the end, right, what we've talked about two main paradigms, right, which is the evidentiary paradigm and the creation of status, Muchzakut versus Raya. We also talked about sort of a middle status that you can read into some of these that it's not that Muchzakut creates definite ownership, it just creates enough of a presumptive control that the burden of proof shifts, right? That's really two possibilities within that model. Again, Rav Naftali Trop goes more in that direction, that by the end of 3 years, we're in a state of suffix, right? But the muhzakut, right, that holding on to the land just shifts the burden of proof, right? So that's like a second and a half model. But we noted that the totally different model, is the way the Ktzot reads the end of the sugya. So I want to make sure to get that, and then I want to go back and look at Rabbi Yona, maybe a Tosot or two. But the Ktzot is tipped off by the fact that the Gemara is bothered by the notion that we should have subjectivity in terms of how long we allow people to protest, and at what point we draw psychological assumptions about silence. The problem is, if you're dealing with evidence, as messy as it is, that should matter. Right? Right? This is really the big problem that Ktzot has to deal with. Right? So I want to, let's spell it out. Is that if you're dealing with evidence, which is based on psychological assumptions that are derived from Andrew didn't yell at Rami, right? Because of taking his kiwis, or, right? Yonadan didn't yell at Adam for building a fence, right? I think those were the examples we talked about. Whatever, really doesn't matter. So then you should demand specific evidence, right? Right? I mean, that makes sense at the end of the day, right? If we're drawing evidence, you know, it's like, you know, like Lahavdil, right? Let's say you go into an American court, right? And they're trying to figure out whether someone committed a crime, okay? And I don't know, you have someone who has a, right? Most people, right, if you want to provide circumstantial evidence that, you know, they might have been involved in a violent crime, right? So you would start bringing evidence. Look, he was angry. You know, he posts on social media that he was going to, that he was so angry that he could hurt somebody, right? And then we saw him running into a room, and the next thing we saw the guy had the person that he said he was going to hurt had a black eye, right? We would all look at that and say, like, okay, that's, halachically it wouldn't stand up, but that's not my point, right? Oh, that's evidence, right? But what if you had someone who you could document that his entire life, he liked writing in opposites, right? When he was happy, he said, I'm angry. When he was angry, he said, I'm happy, right? When he threatened, it meant he was going to give someone a present, right? I don't know, come up with a crazy person. If you could document that, right? So then that person saying, I'm angry, that person saying, I'm going to hurt someone, would not be evidence, and vice versa. Saying, I love him so much, I just want to give him a hug, if in the past, every time he said that, it meant he was about to punch someone in the face, right? That would be de facto evidence, right? Like, evidence is messy sometimes. Like, you need to take context. So the Ktosis problem, essentially, is if this is about evidence, right? Like, does the fact that you were silent show that you really didn't care because it really wasn't yours anymore, right? The reason that Andrew really didn't care was because Rami had, by right, bought the kiwi fields, right? The kiwi orchards. So then you have to take into account the messiness of reality, which is, well, maybe Andrew routinely goes 5 years before he says anything, right? Or maybe he, right, cares after one day. But the fact that the Gemara's retort to, well, shouldn't we care about particularity and specifics, was, then everything's going to be complicated because you won't have a even-keeled, right? You won't have, like, an even quantifiable rule, the answer is, yeah, but so, I mean, I get it. It's messy. We don't like mess. But what are you supposed to do exactly if that's the truth? Right? So the Ketosis solution to this problem is forget it. It's not about evidence at all. This is just a formal rule. And in formal rules, we draw generalities. And we're going to see Rabbeinu Yonah is going to try to solve it differently. He's going to try to keep the evidentiary paradigm, right? And still explain why it works the way it does. But let's look at the Ketos first. So who's the Ketos again? Remind me. He's the only Achron we've basically seen on this again side, or we will see it inside. Who's the Ketos? Do you remember? Blank. If you remember, when we did our tour of Shulchan Aruch, he's one of the most important commentaries on Choshen Mishpat, on monetary law. His name is Rav Arya Leib Heller. Right. He's the counterpart of the Netivot HaMishpat, right? The Nesivis. What otherwise hear him, right? Rav Yaakov ben Yaakov Leuberbaum. Again, I don't know why Yaakov ben Yaakov. I have no idea. I don't know the story behind that. I just know that's his name, right? I don't really understand it. So the Ketos says here, Ulefi Aniodati, his conclusion is as follows. This is the last source that I gave you. Ikar chazaka de shalosh anim eino ela takanat chachamim. My only possible conclusion from this is that Chezkat Gimel Shanim is just a decree. But now he says, but it's not a random decree. It's a decree that is set in place for the good of everybody. And what he does is he says all those things that you thought were points of evidence are Chazal's explanation for why they made the rule the way they did. And how does that work? As follows. Mishum tikkun olam. One. Do lo regile lehizayir bishtar tvei mishalosh. The Sofer HaMach said, given the Yoshev v'toch meshach shalosh anim, ein arer irur. Said point one. Most people don't hold on to their deeds for more than 3 years because they just think that no one's going to challenge them anymore. They assume that after 3 years, if no one said anything, they're not going to say anything anymore. So if you were to not put a limit on how long people have to hold on deeds, then buyers who are just not careful with their documents would lose out. That's point one. We have to care about buyers and recognize that not every buyer has a safety deposit box that he can leave the deed in forever. There has to be, right? Again, this is a world before we can just digitize all the files and you can look it up easily and find everybody's deed, right? It's not necessarily so easy, right? And scribes were expensive and paper is expensive and people don't have the best locks in their door, right? I mean, you look through Bava Metzia, right? Right? You keep things safe by like digging a hole somewhere. Like, you know, it's a different world. Like this is not nowadays where like, you know, we really do expect people to hold on to their deed. I'm trying to think if I know where the deed is to my house. Probably not. Right. Probably have no idea. Right? No. In Israel it's held. I do actually know where the deed to my house is, but there's copies of it anyways kept everywhere in like the I've almost been there 3 years, okay? I'm also the original owner, so like, you know, who's claiming that it's theirs? You know, before I lived in it, it was, you know, hilltop. You know, the whole thing was a hilltop with nobody living there until we all moved in 3 years ago. Like, nobody lived there. They it was beyond the gate. It was just, you know, random. Possibly. Right, possibly. Right? You have to really figure it out, right? Okay. Vama'arer sha'emedito yaseh mecha toch shalosh v'achar mecha gamamachzik yachzik b'shtaro v'meina mocha toch shalosh yafsid ha'me'arer. Right? So, we care about buyers. We say you got 3 years to protest. After that, we're not going to make him hold on to the document, and your protest will mean nothing. And that's what he gets from the Nukei Yosef. Right, so he gets this from Nukei Yosef, who says, V'nitkenu shnehem ma'achzir gam erikam ha'shakata v'zeh l'shon ha'rambam. Okay. And then skip to the next paragraph. He says, "Ayin Tosus Berachas Kedabatim." We look at Tosus Lamed Hey. Tosus has the following question: "Ain Lefarz LaRashi Sover Del Olam Neman Lomer LePerod Horaticha Dimgen Kasher My Tamei Rabban By Shalosh Yom Liyom." You can't always say that I just let someone eat fruit. Dali Day Lekel Maming the Farz Rabba Beis Berachas Ked. The Ad Shalosh Yom Isdar Inish Bishtaro Tvei Lom Isdar Del Olam Srich and LeShamro Pen Yomer LePerod Horaticha. Right, people who are like arisin or sharecroppers actually have to hold on to their deed forever, because otherwise people would just say, "What do you mean? You were my sharecropper. You were allowed to have fruit, but I never gave it to you." But he says, "Vadverem nevarem tzmuin God develom ezari inji b'tshara tzvei shaloshanim I'm yisam chaveriyat chazakat shaloshanim dimkhin chazakat siba shlo yizari tzvei shaloshanim va'ader abba hadlom ezari tzvei shalosh u'siba lechazaka." Because I don't understand. Why not? Right? Why don't they have to hold on to it? Meaning after 3 years, normally you don't have to hold on to it, and that becomes the proof, because once you don't have to hold on to it, if no one challenged it, that's a problem. He kodemet ledin the chazaka shalosh shanim v'imkena afilu neimet in chazaka shalosh shanim raya afilach mizrei tzvei mishalosh mishum desavish lo vaod yiru v'imkena my kashel tzarchli shabish shalosh shalom leberadicha kaven desavish lo yatu otrum yiru va'or al sadeyu. You know, I won't get you too much into his question. Let me give you his answer. V'chinir v'ver adivrehem. This is what it seems to me. The Tosu Tzavri Taimed the Chazaka Gmashikot Mishum Takonet Chachamim Shlo Yavsed Amachzik. The reason for everything is simply that it is a Takana. Kaven Deinu Nizar Bishtaro Tvei Mishalos, because people don't hold on to their Shtar more than three. V'cheven Da'akati Matiyamar L'Peradicha Imkein Ma'o Yil Chacham B'Takonatam. But if people could just say, you're just a sharecropper and you never owned it, so what was the point of the Takana? L'olam Tzach Shmir L'Shtar Shlo Yil L'Peradicha. People could always get around it and say, I didn't challenge you because you were a sharecropper. Right? And that's the problem. That's what they're asking. Well, you're talking about Lama Mahani Chazaka. I will sheet it Ramban, Lamashi Dozo, Chenir Muk, the Iker Chazaka, Mishim Dachachaz, Chachamim. And therefore he says, it must be, it's a Takana. And once we say this, once you have the Takana, so then you can't even claim you were just a sharecropper unless we know that that was the case. Because it's a takana. And at the end of the day, we don't make exceptions for the takana. Right, so in the end of the day, Tos, right, functioning on this, says, look, there's all, basically, if I had to summarize this problem, again, you can look through all the details, but the point is, there are certain cases here where it doesn't seem like evidence fits it, because you could come up with a claim that would undermine evidence, right? And yet, we don't draw that many exceptions, right? Except in cases where we really know that this is, right, you know, he really is a sharecropper or something like that, fine. But I don't understand, if there are these plausible claims that are floating around, so why don't we rely on them, right? Again, if something's about evidence, don't you have to take every possible thing into account to make sure you get the truth? Right, that's basically what the Tos is saying, right? And he said, you look through the sugya, you'll find these places where the evidentiary paradigm is weaker because there is a counterclaim on the evidence that could undermine, and could explain why someone didn't, etc., right? Even after 3 years has a right, etc. The fact that the Gemara is so worried about, you know, coming up with a round number and ceases to care about all these exceptions, doesn't that show that we moved away from the evidentiary paradigm? And that's what the judge says, yes. He says, sure, there's evidence that motivated this. But at the end of the day, the reason we did this was for the good of people. That, in the end of the day, we took an approximation of what is good evidence for most people. We factored in an approximation of how long most people, based on all the realities on the ground, feel like they need to hold on to their evidence. We wrapped that all together and made a reasonable takana. We acknowledge that there are cases where it might not be great, where the evidence might be offered, right? Again, absolute evidence will override the takana, right? We know that, right? Absolute evidence will override the takana, right? That's never in question, right? If, you know, Andrew brings witnesses who say, listen, I owned this field 4 years ago, and then he brings witnesses that say, and then 3.5 years ago, Rami kidnapped me, right? Took my field, kidnapped me, and locked me in a basement somewhere, right? He was benevolent. He left me with endless books and, you know, and Netflix and Disney Plus and whatever, and he fed me well, but all because he was, you know, addicted to kiwis, right? Right? And I have only just escaped after 4 years, right? So sure, at that point, we'd probably give Andrew back his kiwi orchard. But barring that scenario, I'm sorry, Rami. I know. Even in my imagination where you're a criminal, you're a benevolent criminal, but okay, right? I understand it was the kiwis. I get it. I get it. But what? I'm not giving you any ideas, Rami. Don't do this. This is not a good plan. It's not a good vocation for you. But fine. But in the end of the day, right, what the Ksos is saying, barring, right, really good evidence, which obviously will undermine it, the reason that we are willing to look at the generalities and make rules of thumb is because this is a decree. It's a formalized rule motivated by evidence, right? Motivated by psychological assumptions. But this isn't proof itself. This is a step removed from it. And that's why it works on this seemingly arbitrary 3 years, no matter what. And that's the way he ends up concluding the sugya, right? So now we have these three paradigms, right? The muchzakut paradigm with its two variations, right? Either that living actually makes it mine, or at least makes it that I'm the controller enough that the burden of proof shifts to anyone who wants to move me off their property, right? That's paradigm 1A and B. Right, paradigm 2 is the evidentiary paradigm where all these psychological assumptions, etc., provide evidence that Rami is the rightful owner and not Andrew. And then paradigm 3 is no. All of that would be fine and good if you would make exceptions for people who were short-tempered and always protested, their chazaka is created against them in a day. And people who, in general, don't care for long periods of time, chazaka only can be created against them after 5 years or 10 years. If it was pure evidence, you would expect exceptions like that. And that was the Gemara's question. What about these people who, right, as soon as you step on their field, they normally yell at you for trespass, shouldn't you be able to create a chazaka against them immediately? Because if they didn't yell at you, that's de facto evidence that it's yours by right. And that was, and the Gemara's response had been Nasata Litzverech L'Shurin. We don't do that, right? You can't just have, right, subjectively sliding scales. That's not how things work. But the Ksos's problem is, but that is in reality the way evidence works. Evidence has to be fine-tailored, right, fine-tuned, based on the circumstances, the people involved, their psychology, what you saw, how they understand language, right? Meaning, right, I'll give you another example that's less crazy than the person who lives in the opposite world, right? You know, if you had a English speaker, right, who is running after someone angrily, screaming, die, 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 right? You might use that as evidence that person is trying to kill them, right? If you have an Israeli child who's screaming at someone, die, 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 it doesn't mean they want them to die. It means enough, right? Die is enough, right? Enough, I've had it, right? It's important to know which their mother tongue is, right? Because if they're screaming die in their English speakers, that has a very different valence than if they're, right, very different meaning than if they're Israelis and they mean enough, right? Because someone angrily screaming enough, 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 right, is a very different thing than angrily screaming, you know, die, 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 right? These things are important in evidence, right? Yeah, it was... I remember I had this very awkward moment where even English speakers, sometimes you have this, right? Where, you know, American English speakers, the word affair can either mean like, you know, an illicit sexual encounter, right? An affair, right? But it could also mean like a social affair, right? Like, you know, a wedding, a conference, a ball, a prom, whatever, right? That affair means that too, right? And like sometimes you'll just refer to something like a social affair if you don't really know, you know, what it is, right? It's, you know, all those social affairs you go to that you have to wear suits to, whatever, you know, weddings, dinners, you know, all that stuff, right? So when I was in Yeshiva once and I was in Gush, I said to an Australian that I had, you know, like, I needed like a suit to go to like an affair, right? And apparently Australians do not use the word that way. And he like nearly fell over because he thought I was telling him I was going to have some illicit sexual encounter. Like, no, like that's not what it means. That's not the only thing it means in American English. But you can imagine if someone, right, said I was going to an affair, right? So if they're Australian, that means they're acknowledging that, or maybe it's South African, right? I forget who, you know. It means they're acknowledging they're about to be involved in some illicit sexual encounter where, you know, an American might just mean that they're going to a stuffy, right, honor dinner, right, where they have to, oh, I have to go to a formal black tie affair, right? A black tie affair, right? Or when I was talking to one of my British friends where he said that he was very proper, very, very proper, went to like a private, you know, very, very like wealthy, proper, you know, private high school in London. And he said, yes, we were so proper that we routinely attended the gentleman's club. And I'm like, that does not mean the same. That definitely doesn't mean the same thing in British English that it does in American English. I'm like, what is it? And I held it. I'm like, what is a gentleman's club? He's like, oh, it's a place where we went to talk about politics and have tea for tea time. I'm like, oh, that's not what it meant in the gentleman's club that every time I drove to Rambam, there's a gentleman's club off the Rockaway Turnpike, right? It's a different gentleman's club, right? You know, but when you're talking about, like, evidence, you need to take in, like, linguistic cues. But, right, when it comes to formal rules, you can set up a formal rule, whatever, right? Yeah, language confusions are fun, right? You don't expect it always with you don't always expect it when you're dealing with, right, other English speakers, but you get it, right? You know, every so often this would happen in Canada, but Canada is a little bit more similar to American English. Not identical, right? They have their own weird, you know, things that they do, right? And, you know, certain things I just, you know, it takes getting used to, but British and South African and Australian English are more significantly different than America to Canada. Yeah. Fine. And that's what, but at the end of the day, the Ksosis point is that the fact that we don't care about nuance, right, that means we must have moved away from the evidentiary paradigm. Because in the evidentiary paradigm, you do care. We care what die means. We care what affair means, right? We care. Is someone incriminating himself or saying that he's going to a dinner, right? That matters, right? That really does matter. Fine. So what else could you do? Let's say you didn't want to follow the Ksosis model. You wanted to stay within the evidentiary paradigm, right? So then what are you supposed to do with this fact that we've objectified it at 3 years, right? This is the problem, right? Is if the Ksosis is wrong, meaning this is not just the takana. We're still in the evidentiary paradigm. Chazaka is evidence because Andrew should have protested Rami eating his kiwis, and he didn't. So the problem is, then, how can the Gemara so easily get away with just saying, well, it's messy. You know, that's not the miraculous you're in. I don't know. It's just messy. In the end of the day, evidence is messy. So how can the Gemara say, no, we objectify it at 3, if in fact it's about evidence, right? That's the problem, right? We understand the problem, right? Which is, in the end of the day, the Ksos is compelling because if you say, I don't care about details, I don't care about subjective facts on the ground, I just throw out a number and say you have to keep to it, that does point in the direction that it's formalized law that might be motivated by evidence. But it's no longer just evidence. It's a rule. Right? So how do you solve this problem? Right? That's the conceptual problem you got to deal with. Right? Which is, what might the Gemara be saying when it says it's too messy, so we just objectify to three, if in fact it's still working on evidence? How do you square those? Right? And that's where Rabbeinu Yonah comes in. Right? I think Rabbeinu Yonah comes in to solve that problem. Which is, and I've already summarized it, but now you should understand where it comes from. Which is, well, how do we work all these pieces together? The way I think most Rishonim understand it, you look in the Rashba, you'll see this, is that the way the Rava's final argument goes is, Andrew should have protested Rami. The fact that he didn't for 3 years is the evidence that it in fact Rami's property. Aye, so what is this factor of 3 years? He doesn't hold on to his document. The answer is, look, after 1 year, so Rami has accumulated a certain amount of evidence. After two more, after three more, after four, it would be even more. After five, it would be even more. So why is it that we allow Rami to get away with Chazaka and not Shtar after 3 years? Right? Why is it that for year one and two, we allow Andrew to demand higher level evidence, right? A deed. And after year three, we don't. Why don't we wait till four? What is this magic number? So the way most people understand it is because, look, after there are 3 years, he's accumulated a certain amount of evidence. And the counterclaim, which is, why don't you have your deed? Why don't you allow me to rely on higher levels of evidence or demand higher levels of evidence, falls away because normal people by that point just don't hold on to their shtar, so we're left sufficing with whatever evidence we've accumulated from 3 years of Andrew being silent. Right? That's the way I think most Rishonim understand it. The problem is, if that's how you understand it, the ketosis question is really good. Right? Which is, I mean, okay, but what if Andrew is such a nice guy that he normally doesn't let, right, he normally doesn't care until year five? Doesn't that show that Rami didn't accumulate that evidence until year five? Or what if Andrew is short-tempered? Shouldn't he have accumulated after 1 year? He's not. Let's say, I'm short-tempered, okay? Fine, whatever, I don't care, right? I'm not accusing you. This is all theoretical. This should be clear. I'm not accusing Rami of kidnapping people to steal kiwis, right? This is all theoretical, right? Very, very theoretical. Counterfactual even, okay? So it gets hard, right? And that's where the ketosis is coming from, which is, you know, and that's where Rabbeinu Yonah says, aha, I want to stay in the evidentiary paradigm, but I'm going to flip it on you and say as follows. Until now, you've been assuming that what created the evidence, the fact that Andrew didn't say anything, and the fact that after 3 years, people don't care about their deeds anymore is just why we basically cut it off there, right? It's pretty arbitrary. It's like, yeah, maybe at some level he accumulated enough evidence after 2 years, but the fact that he should have held on to his shtar means that we'll demand more. And at 4 years, yeah, sometimes not enough evidence is accumulated, but we have to let him suffice with minimal evidence because he doesn't have a shtar anymore, right? That's just the way things work. Fine. Rabbeinu Yonah says, no, I got it. It's the other way around. I'll summarize it again outside, and then we'll see it inside. Rabbeinu Yonah says, you don't understand. You thought that the evidence is because Andrew didn't protest? No, it's Andrew didn't protest. This is how it works. After 3 years, most people don't hold on to their deed. And therefore, after 3 years, we stop caring about the deed. That reality itself is what sets the groundwork for proof. Why? Because as long as we can demand the deed from Rami, and Andrew knows that he can demand the deed from Rami, his silence proves nothing, because he'll just say, the reason I was silent was because I knew that I could demand Rami provide his deed, and since I believe that he didn't buy it from me, I know he doesn't have a deed. But once the court will accept Rami's defense after years, after 3 years, that I don't have the deed because I'm, you know, a little bit messy, and I don't hold on to all my documents after 3 years, and the court will buy that, and Andrew stays silent anyways, that creates the proof. So according to the Rabbinioni, you know why it's 3 years? Because the proof, it's not enough. In the end of the day, or the Havamina of the Gemara was that the evidence was created by Andrew's silence. But if that's the case, it's arbitrary, because some people are short-tempered, and their silence for a day should be enough to prove that this is not trespass. For some people, they're so calm that it would take 5 years to build up that type of proof. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, no, we reject that. We flip it, and we say, no, it's not evidence that someone didn't protest. It's evidence that someone gave up their opportunity to protest when they know the court would have demanded proof. The fact that you gave up that 3-year window, that's what creates the proof. Right? And that's why I said it's like this game theory thing. It's not that I didn't protest. It's the fact that I know that after 3 years, the court is going to let Rami say that I gave up on my document because I no longer expected anyone to protest, and the court is going to buy that argument, creates the psychological reality in which I need to actually protest within that time, because if I don't protest within the time that the court is going to buy your argument, well then, Mimela, I'm showing that I don't have an argument, because I let the 3 years pass me by when I had the upper hand. No one would give up the upper hand that was created by this game theory getting into everybody's heads unless they really didn't own it. But that's why 3 years is important, because it's not just the fact that I didn't protest. It's the fact that I never protested in the entire time when the court would give me the upper hand and demand that Rami provide his deed. That 3 years is necessary to set up the psychological framework in which silence is a proof. Right? So that's the way that Rabbeinu Yonah saves the evidentiary paradigm. So let's look at Rabbeinu Yonah. He says, Elamarava Shata Kamaita Mizdar Inish Bishtare. Trey Mizdayer, Tlatlo Mizdayer. Perish. Kaven de Tvelo Mizdayer. Since after 3 years people don't hold on to their documents. Havele Limchot. It's the fact that he was going to give up his deed after 3 years, that meant you should have protested before he can be expected and excused for giving up his deed. Umidlo micha. Since you didn't protest in the protestable time, when you had the legal upper hand, amrinan devadaizavna, lefishe etil chachamam of limchot. Because by granting Rami reprieve after 3 years and telling him you don't have to hold on to your document, the fact that I know that Rami knows that after 3 years the court will accept his laziness and messiness and whatever and not carry it under the document means that I have to respond to that causal chain. Right? And that's why it's 3 years. Because it's actually the fact that the court will no longer need the deed that creates the psychological reality in which my silence is meaningful. So again, so according to Rabbeinu Yonah, what he'll tell you is, it's not a takana, it's evidence. But there's a slight bit of takana in it, and that is that after 3 years, the rabbis accept the claim that I didn't hold to my deed anymore. It's not a takana. It's basically procedure. It's an arbitrary court procedure that sets in motion the possibility of the evidentiary paradigm. Okay? Meaning, the court decided after 3 years, because most people don't hold on to their shtar, they're going to accept that as a legitimate thing to do. But the fact that the court chose 3 years, maybe arbitrarily, that's not going to be a takana. Is that the fact that the court set court procedure that after 3 years they don't demand the deed is what makes it Andrew has to respond to this causal chain and say, if Rami knows that the court won't kill after 3 years, and therefore is not going to hold on to his deed, then that means that if I don't protest within 3 years, and Rami isn't able to provide evidence that it's his, the court will no longer care, and therefore I have an upper hand until then. But after that, he has the upper hand, and nevertheless, I'm silent. I would only be silent under that circumstance if I really didn't have a claim. So therefore, I'd better speak up within the 3 years. It's not a sakana. It is evidence. Right? It's just evidence that is actually created. Right? So according to the Ksos, it's, right? Rabbi Yonah is the exact opposite of the Ksos. The Ksos says we started with the evidentiary paradigm, which motivated a formalization into a takana, which is now not strictly based on evidence. Rabbi Yonah says the opposite, which is, no. We started with evidence, took that to create court protocol, and then the fact that you didn't respond to court protocol instead generated an evidentiary paradigm, right? So when evidence, formalization in court, which itself creates the hard and fast evidence that we need, which is you didn't respond to the court paradigm, right? So both the Ksos and Menyona believe there is some sort of formalization that happens in the court, but the Ksos thinks we start with evidence which motivates a formal rule, a formal takana, which is no longer simply based on evidence. Rabbi Yonah says we started with sort of a vague notion of evidence that motivated a objective 3-year court rule, which itself created the evidentiary paradigm, because it created a reality in which you have to protest within 3 years if you want to maintain your upper hand. So by the end, both the Ksos and Menyona think there's an element of evidence and an element of formalization, but the question is, what is primary? For the Ksos, the evidentiary psychological assumptions led to a formalization, but by the end, that formalization is true, even when it may not provide absolute evidence. And for the Rabbi Yonah, the exact opposite is the case. If we start with a set of vague psychological assumptions which led us to pick a basically arbitrary date at which we'll stop asking for hard proof. And that set into motion a psychological reality in which anyone who is willing to give up the upper hand for 3 years must not really be an owner. But what we're left with is that in the end of the day, it's not the takana. The takana is what set in motion a hard evidentiary paradigm rather than the other way. Right? So by the end, Rabbi Yonah is left with evidence. What? Correct. That's what I said. It's like game theory. Right? Rabbi Yonah is very game theory. It's I know that he knows that I know that he knows that I know that he knows that I know that. By the end, it's evidence, right? In the end of the day, sure. One step in this whole game theory process of why I think that he knows that I know that he knows that he knows, etc., is that the rabbi set a rule, right? But the rabbi setting a rule is just one stage in this self-perpetuating psychological assumption of what I know that he knows that I know that he knows that I know that he knows that I know that he knows, right? Right? You get this. Right, the most fun time where you get this is in Bava Machteret, right? Right, by Bava Machteret, right, if someone is burrowing into your house, you're allowed to kill them because you assume that they're allowed to kill you, right? But the Rishonim of Machloket, right, how did this work? Is it he's coming into my house and is ready to kill me so I can kill him in advance, or he's coming into my house and he knows that I'm willing to kill him. And since he knows I'm willing to kill him, he's willing to kill me. But since he knows that I would kill him, and now that makes him willing to kill me, I'm actually allowed to kill him, right? That's a machlok rishonim, right? Sometimes things get messy. That's game theory for you, right? Is how many layers of I know that he knows that I know that he knows that I know that he knows that, right? That's why it creates this nightmare, right? Fine. Professor Alman is cool. You should just know that. You know, the Israeli economist who won the Nobel Prize for his work on game theory, right? He's cool. When I was in the Kollel in Gush, he came to give shiur on how he thinks game theory explains the complicated sugya in Ksubos. Fun times. Very fun. Okay. So what we are left with is, to summarize, Muchzakut, that Chesed Gimel Shanim is actual status created. I am either the owner or the controller, which is enough to shift the burden of evidence, right? 1A, 1B. 2, evidence. 3, takana. But within evidence and takana, they may play off of each other. The Kso says that the evidence and psychological assumptions motivated a formalization, which into a takana, which may or may not prove anything at this point. It does most of the time, but admittedly it might not, because in the end of the day, the final nature of Chesed Gimel Shanim is a takana, or a binyona says, no, the final paradigm is evidence. How do you explain the arbitrary number 3? Because, yeah, part of what set the full evidentiary paradigm in motion, the one that we conclude with, is not just he should have protested, but he should have protested in the time when he had the ability to demand more proof based on the rules set up in court. But the rules are not the end. They're one step in this game theory process that creates the psychological proof by the end. Okay? The only last thing I will note here, besides for saying, yes, we didn't go through all the Rishonim, yes, you'll see the Tosos is a slightly different model, and the Rajba is a slightly different model, and forgive me that we didn't. We are not going through every... You have forgiven me. I will forgive myself. I am trying to forgive myself for not doing every Rishon, or Tosos has to forgive me or whatever, right? You, I know, forgive me. You're like, thank God you didn't give us more reading. Yeah, I got it. I understand. The people in my Tikva course have a taste of what it looks like when I have less limits, and like I said, only a taste, because, you know, it's only 172 pages. It's not the 250 that it was last week, and not the 500 it was 2 weeks ago, right? You know? And like I said, even when I gave in 500 pages, right, Brody said to me, it was unclear to me, was that meant to be the reader? Is that what you had in your own notes? I'm like, no, the 500 was I was originally thinking of the reader. You want mine? That's the 1,000 pages or whatever that I was thinking about, right? Like, things get slowly cut. I do have that thing, so whatever. I was so happy they were letting me do a reader. 170 pages is still better than one, you know? At least that. The last thing I will note is that you will find that we've shown him certain other hybrid models, such as many of the Achronim believe, and I don't want to get into the exact proof of how they get this, that the Ramban has a very complicated model, which goes like this. Muchzakut is created after 1 year, not 3. Meaning, people become the de facto owners after 1 year. And really, all things being equal, after 1 year, the burden of proof should shift to Andrew away from Rami. But the fact that most people keep their deeds for 3 years means that it's reasonable for us to not let you rely on the control paradigm that was created after year one, because we have reasonably 3 years where we should be able to demand evidence from you, because you should be holding on to your star. But after 3 years, when people no longer hold on to their star, we revert and allow you to rely on the control paradigm, which, if we're honest with ourselves, took effect after year one, or immediately, not after year 3. Right? So some of the Achronim think the Ramban has this hybrid model, right? Which is muchzakut. Right, this quasi-ownership is created after year one, which should shift the burden of proof to the original owner away from the new owner. But the fact that most people hold on to their evidence for 3 years means that we don't allow you to rely on the lower-level proof, lower-level control paradigm, and demand that you work in ultimate evidence paradigm by providing a document. But once we get to the point where normal people don't hold on to documents, so then we move away from the evidentiary paradigm back to the Muchzakut paradigm, which really had taken effect after 1 day or 1 year, much earlier in the process. There are all types of very complicated hybrid models like that you'll find in the Achronim, right? So we were not exhaustive in every nuance, but I think that is sufficient. I think this is Shir 7, 6 or 7, I don't even know anymore. 6? Wait, let's see. We did conceptual overview. Shor Muad. The problems with Shor Muad. Rava, Ramban, Ritva. No, this is day six. Day six, right? Day six, Ksos Rabbeinu Yonah. Those are the paradigms of Cheskes Gimel Shanim, the basics, the very basics of Cheskes Gimel Shanim. Now you can say you have done the most classic yeshiva shtugya in Bava Basra, so we have done it. Here's the question. I was originally planning for next week of going on to a question with, you know, some of the other questions within it, which is, you know, what exactly... You know, I do think we have to spend a little bit more time, not just on the Chazaka in general, but probably at least one shiur on Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Kiva, right? Remember that not everyone agrees it's 3 years. We should at least examine Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Kiva. How do they get to 14 months? How do they get to 18 months? We do need to... I'm okay saying we're not going to do it in as much depth as we did Cheskes Gimel Shanim. I do think we should at least do that, and we should probably do the next sugya here, which is... the Ritzifut HaChazaka, right, which is how, right, the Gemara's question of do you have to do it 3 years in a row or not? So I do think we need to spend a few days on some of these smaller issues within it. After that, I'm open again to doing what you want to do. I do think we should at least do an overview of Momen HaMutal B'Safek, because I think it's very fascinating, right, which is how do rabbis deal with lack of absolute evidence, all the different things. Yachloku, right, dividing, Kol Delam Gvar, let people... punch it out, right, until the best man wins, leave it till Elio. All that stuff is really fascinating. You should see that once during the year, so we're definitely going to do that. That's what I would want to move to, I think, after we polish off a few of these smaller issues in Chazaka and jump around a little in the Perek. We could keep going through things here. You guys want to see how Macha'a leads into Lashon Hara, the main Lashon Hara Sugya? Are you interested in that? Think about it. Okay, do you want to deal with inheritance law, the eighth perek, some of those sugyas? Are you interested in doing what Rabbi Ginsburg does sometimes and switching over to a little bit of Sota and do something totally different? Think about it. Okay, let me know. Fine.